this week on Dig Me Out.
Jay, we're back again with another episode thanks to our Dig Me Out Union on Patreon. You can help us make the next episode happen by joining us at dmounion.com or digmeoutunion.com. And once again, it's been too long, Chip. How have you been?
I have been fantastic since the last time we talked. There's a lot going on. A lot going on around here.
So much going on. We barely get to see each other. We're literally doing this back to back with other episodes. It's so much fun to just spend an evening just pretending that we're not talking to each other repeatedly. Interview time. What have you got lined up for us with this episode?
Okay, so before I talk about what I've got lined up, I want to mention that you guys had Rob Harbilla on not too long ago talking about Elastica, and he is the host of the podcast 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, and he's got a book. And Rob, you know, both the podcast and the book, it's a lot of storytelling. It's not just taking a song and dissecting the song. It's, you know, all like he kind of goes off all over the place on songs. So tonight on this interview, it's with Glenn and Keith Kohanowitz from the band Riverside. And I'm not going to get too deep into the story, but I discovered Riverside because of a girl that I dated in college. So the timing was 1992. I was backwards hat wearing, long hair, nose pierced, flannel wearing, Doc Martin wearing, baggy cargo shorts, Chip Midnight at the time.
Whoa. Wow. That's quite an image.
It's the nose ring that gets me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, I know. Play that back. I'm going to put that in the mid journey and have it generate the image.
Yeah. I mean, I had hair down past my shoulders, but it looked terrible because even at that age, my hairline was. It wasn't terrible, but it was receding. So I always wore it in a ponytail and a backwards baseball hat, either a Beastie Boys or a Pantera backwards baseball hat.
Mm.
A lot of flannel shirts, a lot of cargo shorts. And like I said, the black Doc Martens with the cargo shorts.
Classic. Look.
And so I met this girl in college and we started dating, and she was as big of a music fan as I was, but into completely different stuff. And so I was exposed to so much different music that was like not in my wheelhouse at all, coming out of 80s hair metal into 90s grunge. And she was a big NME and Melody Maker reader. I don't know that she bought them, but we would go to like the Little Professor bookstore and go to like the import magazines and flip through them and just like spend half an afternoon just reading everything without actually spending the $15 on the import prices. But she was really into the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s kind of alternative stuff coming out of the UK. So Riverside, as it is from Pennsylvania. And I tell Glenn and Keith, the two brothers from the band, that I'm sure in 1992, I absolutely assume they are from England. Why wouldn't they have been from England? They kind of have that, like, their sound was so different from what was going on in the alternative charts in the early 90s from America that, you know, like I said, they were definitely influenced by like bands like the Smiths. They were really into, they lived close to the Ocean Blue. I don't know if you guys have covered the Ocean Blue or if you're familiar with the Ocean Blue, but another band that I thought was from the UK, again, they're from Pennsylvania, and the Ocean Blue was absolutely instrumental in Riverside getting signed to a label. The other band that my girlfriend at the time turned me on to was a band called the Judy Bats, another band. I don't know that you've covered. Have you covered them?
Nope.
Another band that I
know the name.
I don't think it was until like, so I dated her in 92. Broke up, started dating my wife now in 94. I think it was probably the early 2000s when I came across a Judy Bats and Riverside CD somewhere that I picked up and was like flipping through. And I'm like, these guys, like the Judy Bats are from like Georgia or Tennessee or something. But they had like a late 80s UK, kind of a lighter alternative pop sound to them. But Riverside is a CD that I've had when I put it on now, like it's one of those albums that kind of takes me back. Like I listen to it and I'm like visiting that girl that I dated in her dorm room, and we're listening to music and we're, you know, whatever. But they put out one record and then got dropped. And so like they were a one album and done. They did have a single called Waterfall that there's a video. Again, for me, I listened to it. I'm like, oh yeah, this was a hit. I don't know if it was a hit or not, but they did have, they did have that. But there's a label called Lost in Ohio, which I'm not totally familiar with. I think they put out some Ohio bass bands. They put out, they reissued some stuff by a band called Morella's Forest. And the guy that runs the label started a Kickstarter for the Riverside album to issue it on vinyl for the first time ever. That was how I got in touch with these guys. My friend Tim, who is a independent publicist out of Dayton, reached out. I was on this press list and, you know, it's like, hey, announcing this Kickstarter for Riverside to issue their album on vinyl. And I was like, man, Riverside, I haven't thought of that band in 20 years. The good news is they reached their Kickstarter goal. So the album is going to get made on vinyl. It is still available. And, you know, I'm sure in, as they say in the biz, in the show notes, we can put links to how to get it. Even though the Kickstarter is done, the album is still available to order. A really great sounding alternative pop with UK influences album from the early 90s. But Glenn and Keith are the brothers. They have kept, as brothers, you know, unlike the Gallagher brothers, no big fights. They haven't broken up. They continue to make music. They've led adult lives that don't involve music. But I think that they're having a lot of fun right now, just going back and getting to revisit that time in their life. And they, you know, again, that relationship with the Ocean Blue continues. So every once in a while, the Ocean Blue will play a show. When I talked to them, they still live in Pennsylvania. I think they had just gotten back from Austin, Texas for a couple sold out shows in Texas in general with, the Ocean Blue. The Ocean Blue tours so infrequently that like when they play, they sell out where they play. And so Riverside has had some chances to play some shows with them. And so, you know, we'll see what happens in the future, but it was cool talking to Glenn and Keith about their past, getting to understand that they're from Pennsylvania and not London. And just really great guys. It was a fantastic conversation. Really enjoyed it. And we probably could have talked for another 2 or 3 hours beyond what we talked about. So
very cool. Well, let's go to that interview with the guys whose name I'm not going to pronounce. Riverside. Thanks, Chip.
Welcome to another Dig Me Out interview episode. I am thrilled to be joined by two members of the band Riverside. Now, before we talk about Riverside, Dig Me Out, as the listeners know, is all about these underappreciated, overlooked albums and CDs from the 90s. And I think, and I'll ask for confirmation here, Riverside seems to be one of those bands. I'm aware of Riverside. I own the CD, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. And you guys got some MTV play, and you sold some records. But in the grand scheme of the 90s, you probably could have had more visibility. Is that fair to say? And let me introduce you guys. So we'll have Keith and Glenn, brothers. We'll start off with Keith. Maybe introduce yourself and talk about your role in the band, and then we'll toss it over to Glenn.
Sure. This is Keith. I'm the lead singer and one of the guitar players. Glenn and I have been doing this for a very long time. We've had a couple different band members here and there, but that's it.
Glenn?
And this is Glenn, and I play bass and sing some backing vocals too. But speaking to bands that get lost in the shuffle, we were one of those many bands that had that happen to us. And we came along American band on the heels of all those British bands like the Smiths, Echo and the Bunnymen, The Cure, and so forth. And on the forefront of bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam and so forth. So we were squeezed in the middle of that thing. That didn't help. Pre-internet, that didn't help. But the positive thing about bands that and fans that really loved us is that we still have a fan base, and those fans that still like us, they think of us, which is mind numbing to Keith and I. It's like, we're like the Smiths or the Beatles. We're their favorite record ever. That's why we wanted to release this old record on vinyl. So for some fans of ours, they don't distinguish the difference of all. We're fans with all those famous bands, but that's what's keeping us going over all these years.
So I'm guessing we're probably all in the same age range, and we don't have to necessarily talk about ages, but late 80s, when I was in high school, I was all about heavy metal. And that was it, One Track Mind. And then I went to college, and I saw, in 1 week, I saw Bret Michaels from Poison do a solo show at a venue in Columbus, Ohio, called the Newport Music Hall, which holds 1,800, but there's probably 600 people. And 3 nights later, I saw Nirvana, and my life literally, it's so cliche to say, but it changed. My life changed in the matter of 3 days. I started dating this girl in college. So I'm all in. I'm wearing flannel shirts. I have Doc Martens. I got my nose pierced. I actually had hair. I had hair, believe it or not, at one point. I started dating this girl in college, and she's like, I read NME and The Melody Maker. And I'm like, I don't know what those are. I read alternative press, right? Like, I don't know what you're talking about. And as we start dating, we start, you know, trading music collections. And there was very little similarity between what I was listening to and what she was listening to. But the three CDs that I ended up buying because of her were The Posies, Frosting on the Beater, The Judy Batts, I can't remember the name of the record.
One of our favorites.
And then Riverside. And those albums, because I spent so much time with her whenever I was at her dorm room, she was not listening to Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, and Pearl Jam. She was listening to The Posies, The Judy Batts, and Riverside. And so I have a soft place in my heart for you guys, even though, like, had I not met her, I probably would have never heard your music before.
Wow.
So tell me, where were you guys, like, in the late 80s? Like, you were not listening to Iron Maiden and Judas Priest, were you?
No. I graduated high school in 86. And at that point, I was pretty deep into Echo and the Bunnymen, Gary Numan, all those bands. But as far as our band, what we were doing right then, I think at that point, Glenn and I were in another band with two of our cousins, two other, Mark and Andrew, plus another buddy. And the name of our band, and we thought we were really original at the time, was called Blue Monday. So hence we were sounded a little bit like New Order back then. But that's what we were doing at that point, you know, doing shows and trying to figure things out. I didn't sing at that point. My cousin sang, and we were just trying to figure out how to write songs and how to be in a band.
How did you discover that kind of music, like in 86? Again, I was reading Hit Parade or Magazine and Circus Magazine, and there was no, well, I don't know if there was 120 minutes at the time.
Like, no.
How did you guys discover all that stuff?
It's very specific. I mean, Glenn and I have an older brother, 6 years older than me. He kind of introduced us to some of these bands, Gary Numan, but he was more of like into bands like The Pretenders and Cheap Trick, Elvis Costello. So we were pretty young when that stuff first came out, but it really just opened up our ears to that whole different genre of music. But then very, even more important than that, we had a brother-in-law who was also about 5 years older than us. And he had bands like Depeche Mode, things like that, which we had never heard of, had no clue. I knew about Kraftwerk and things like that, but New Order, bands like that. So he was very pivotal in like opening up, you know, our interest up to music in that area.
Yeah.
Couple things.
Yeah.
The Judy Batts were on our label, managed by the same management company, and we toured with them for 3 months. And living with those guys for 3 months, we were y'all this and y'all that. They're from Knoxville, Tennessee. So that's crazy. So that your girlfriend knew the Judy Batts and us.
Because I guess she went to one of our shows.
Probably. Small world.
And I have to tell you, for both you and the Judy Batts, I don't know when the light bulb clicked for me or turned on for me. I thought both of you were from England. Like, when I found out the Judy Batts were from Georgia?
Knoxville, Tennessee.
When I found that out, my mind, and I only found that out about 5 years ago, my mind was absolutely blown. I'm like, those guys are British. They're British.
We were fake British. They weren't fake British. Okay. But another thing you mentioned that was very interesting, NME, New Musical Express, and Melody Maker. I was at Temple University, and we had a library there, and they had once a week, they'd get those issues in. I would read those things cover to cover. That was part of our indoctrination and really, really delving into deep stuff. Keith mentioned our brother-in-law and my uncle Greg, he was really into that more Beatles-esque kind of alternative kind of stuff after that in the late 70s. But our brother-in-law, Steve Adams, but then we really developed our own thing from there, from A Flock of Seagulls to the Railway Children to all those big bands like The Cure and the Smiths. And there was a radio station. There was no 120 minutes didn't really happen back then, I don't think. But there was a couple of local radio things, like an hour a week, a show called Rock Over London. They would play cool stuff. WPRB out of Princeton, New Jersey, great alternative. TSR, which Trenton State Radio, whatever it was. That's where I first heard the Smiths on that Rock Over London. I went to Third Street Jazz downtown in Philadelphia and bought the import 7-inch. $2.99 for a British import 7-inch. That was fun.
I think a lot of the listeners of this podcast are, you know, fans of 90s music, probably a little bit older than kids. And so they understand that. But, you know, for the younger people, like understanding that there was no internet, there was no YouTube, there was no Spotify. Like, I don't know about you guys. I mean, it sounds like you were lucky that you could hear some of that stuff. But oftentimes you'd go to the record store and just buy something because of the cover. Or because it was on a label that another band you liked was on. Like you just took a chance. There was no hearing five singles on YouTube before you bought it.
No. And just back to our uncle Greg, who was more of a Beatles kind of guy, but the combination of him being our uncle, he was, you know, about 15, 16 years older than us, and he was a musician as well. So he was huge. If it wasn't for him, I don't think we ever would been musicians at all. He had a guitar, he was in a band, he was about 15 years older than us, and dang, he was pretty darn cool. So that inspired me to get a guitar, and then shortly thereafter Glenn got a bass, and our cousins we were in a band with, he was their uncle as well. So it was it was a lot of fun but he was, you know, huge in our influence.
Yeah.
As far as buying records by the cover, there was a fantastic record store in Northeast Philadelphia called The Record Cellar. And they had promo copies. I would definitely $3.99 used or a promo copy. That record looked cool. Or we talked to the owners of the store. And they were local record label guys too. There was a band called The Flight of Mavis. They were like a big Philly indie band. But those guys knew what I wanted. I was there every week. We'd walk there, you know, in the middle of the winter, or 15 years old, to buy records for $3 or $4 used. That album cover is cool, I'm buying it. This owner of the store knows what we like, I'm buying it. There's a band called The Bible, this guy Boo Hewadine. I remember they said, oh, you like the Railway Children, that kind of melody, you'll love these guys.
Yep, and they were right.
They were right.
They knew.
I mean, that was a whole different world back then. It was the microcosm of, you know, social media, but it was just social skills and talking to people, you know. It was a great time. It's a different time, that's for sure.
It was exciting, so exciting to go to that record seller store. Oh my goodness, it was about 3 or 4 miles away, whether we jumped on the bus or walked there to get some new vinyl and these guys were a little bit older than us that owned the place. So God knows how they were hearing about these bands, but yeah, looking at the album covers. I'm sure I grabbed a few, some good, some bad albums because the covers look pretty cool. Yeah. You know, just trying to do the new wave thing back then.
So as a metal kid, I wouldn't buy it because it was too expensive, but I'd flip through Kerrang! Magazine at the record store. And I'd go to the back and I'd see all the bands that I liked and who they were touring with in the UK. And so like, I remember Black Sabbath was, this band Fields of the Nephilim were opening for Black Sabbath. Mm-hmm. Never heard of them. They didn't have any singles. They weren't on MTV. And I bought that cassette because they were opening for Black Sabbath. I figured like Black Sabbath wouldn't have just a bad band open for them.
Sure. They must be cool.
Yeah. Do you know those guys? They're sort of like gothy kind of,
can't say
you know, like I'll say that like they were for 14 or 15 year old, they were sort of creepy. Like they had some like creepy music. They scared me, but it was a good scare, you know. It was like But so when you started playing this music, were you were your peers, were your friends into it? Or were they just like, you don't, 86, 87, I'm trying to think who would have been big at that time. Like, you probably didn't sound like any of the stuff that they were listening to on the radio.
No, I had, when I first got a guitar, I had two other buddies who had guitars that I went to high school with. Their favorite bands were Judas Priest, Ozzy Osbourne, all that. And they just thought my stuff was so silly, the bands I was listening to. So it's funny, there were two of my closest friends but at that time, but we never jammed. It was just like we were in complete different worlds. But outside of my brother and my cousins, maybe one or two other friends. I can remember when we went to see the Smiths for the Meet Is Murder tour. And this is 1984, 85. And at the Tower Theater, pretty, you know, cool spot in Philadelphia. And we get there. And in my mind, I was thinking, who else is possibly going to be here to see this band? It was the greatest show in the world. So they're out there. But we were pretty young at that point. I was like 15 or 14 years old. So I think the people that were into those bands were just a little bit older, but they weren't our classmates. They weren't people in our neighborhood. But that's what I recall.
Well, the big difference was our local high school was one world, and we were both like baseball players back then. But then once we got to college, you know, that expands your horizon a little bit. We met a lot of kids. Actually, we lived in Philadelphia, and there was no cable, so there was no MTV where we lived. Yeah. But our friends in the suburbs who went to school and college where we were in college, they had cable television. They had MTV. So I had a girlfriend who would tape 120 minutes for me on VHS every Sunday night and just give it to me. I would watch that. And lo and behold, one day we ended up on there. But that was a big transition. We, you know, you had to dig deep to find all that stuff. But those mid to late 80s, we were getting early into college. We started to really find out about a lot of different kind of bands. We became closer with our cousins who were in our first band. And as Keith said before, it was more of that Flock of Seagulls, New Order, those kind of bands to start, Depeche Mode. But then we kind of moved on from there to more of the jangle pop melodic kind of things like the Railway Children, like Aztec Camera. That was a huge influence for us. And always the Beatles and things like that were in the background, the basis for all of our love of music as well.
So was it going to college, is that when kind of what the nucleus of Riverside started?
That was huge, really was huge. When we first went to college, we were still in that initial band, but things just started to fade a little bit. I think Glenn and I were getting more involved with some of these guitar bands, the Smiths, things like that. And I don't think the other guys in the band were as into that stuff. And I didn't sing then, so for whatever reason, you know, it's Glenn and I decided to kind of like move on, and the other guys moved on. And we were a three-piece for a little while. We had keyboard players playing with us, but nothing ever really connected. And then I met Kenny Jackson. And sadly, you know, Kenny is gone. He passed 2 years ago now, and Kenny was a gigantic part of Riverside. And I met Kenny my sophomore year at Penn State. I was just going to the Penn State local campus, and Kenny was just this kid with a cool haircut, you know, and that's how we connected. And he was a huge Cure fan, and oh, he was, collection of albums was endless. So we just loved music. And he was probably one of my first, you know, friends that I connected with on that level, who just was so into this music, and we got really, really close. And at that time, he was not a musician. And, you know, Glenn and I had tried out different guitar players. And to me, it's always not just someone to jam with. You got to connect with them on such a special level to be able to write and to spend that kind of intimate time together when you're working on music. So I said, Kenny, why don't you learn how to play the guitar? Why don't you pick up a guitar? And he did. You know, I kind of got him started, showed him this and that, but then he just took off. And just as much as he loved all those music, he loved being a guitar player. And it was exactly what we needed, and became integral part of the writing process. So as far as college, if I don't meet Kenny, you know, who knows? Maybe we can wind up being more of a keyboard band or something like that. You know, it's, but that was giant. And, you know, we miss him terribly.
Yeah. Kenny was heavy into all the British bands, and he grew up near Princeton. So if anybody near Princeton is into alternative music or any music at all, they know the Princeton Record Exchange. It's a famous, like, you know, independent record store still there, right there in the beautiful campus of Princeton. So Kenny used to live in the Princeton Record Exchange, and then we kind of brought him out of that record store, listening to stuff, learning to play guitar. Then he became, used to live in Sam Ash and those guitar stores that, you know, that would sell guitars. Yeah. And when he passed away, unfortunately, a few years ago, we were hanging out with his brother, just looking through his guitar collection. He must have 15 guitars. I mean, he would buy and sell and buy and sell and buy and sell Rickenbackers, cool old Fenders, Jaguars, Jazz Masters, great big Taylor acoustics. Kenny was a great kid, great man. It's a shame he's no longer with us, but he was a big influence, a big part of that kind of direction that we started to go for that first record, which is what we are re-releasing on vinyl, which has been funded by this Kickstarter campaign. Kenny was a big influence on all those sounds.
Yeah. Was the dream to become musicians and make a living at it? Or did you fall into it? Or was it something that, like, you actively were dreaming about?
Absolutely dreaming about. I don't think I ever took it casually. You know, from the first moment I had a guitar, not that I thought I was going to get a record deal back then, but I mean, I just didn't do it casually, and neither did Glenn. So initially we didn't know too much of what we were doing, but we were passionate and we put time in. I mean, this was every day hammering away and just trying to figure out how to be better songwriters. But yeah, it really is something we just dedicated so much time. I think we drove some previous musicians out of our band because it was 4 or 5 nights a week. And, you know, we're going to college at this time. It didn't make it easy. Thankfully, our parents were very accommodating to us making a lot of noise in the garage. But yeah, we were just, and then little things happened that made us think, you know what, maybe this could happen. You know, we met these guys that were in called the Ocean Blue, who are from, you know, from Pennsylvania. Glenn met Steve Lau first. He was a student in Philadelphia. And if we watched what happened with them, you know, they had a band. Oh, Sire Warner is interested in them. Oh, they got a record deal. Oh, they're flying to England to have John Porter produce their first record. It was just amazing. Sire Records, all of our favorite. It was amazing. And we loved what they did. So when we saw it happen for them, you know, we were still figuring things out, but it made us think this could really happen.
Yeah. It's a combination of things. I was walking along South Street in Philadelphia with my friend Paul Henderson, who is a great singer in this band Ceiling Zero. And we walked past this club called JC Dobbs, where we used to play sometimes, like a local, you know, club forever. And we saw this cool band of this guy, these young, like, kids, like, playing the Ocean Blue. I got to stop in and see them. Lo and behold, they look like they're some British band, but they were from Lancaster County, you know, and I just happened to go see them. Like, oh my God, they're like the best local band I've ever seen ever. They were, unbeknownst to me, they are about to get signed to Sire, this bidding war, you know, and they had some great, fantastic songs. I got to know that guy, Steve Lau, as Keith mentioned, and we got to know all of them eventually. And that was a real inspiration that to really give us an idea, like, this is a positive. They can write these songs, and they're not these crazy complex songs. There's great, catchy, cool songs that we all love. And we could do that. And that's what we were doing as well. And lo and behold, we became really close with those guys. Steve Lau became a great friend of mine, and he ended up producing, helping us connect with those record company folks. He always takes talent, but it takes some luck, and it takes a little bit of connection, a combination of all those things.
Yeah.
Steve Lopp produced our first record, you know, and the rest is history, I guess we can say.
Was it always Riverside? Was that always the name, or did you?
No, we went through some names, some silly, some. But that first band was Blue Monday. But as Glenn and I, as I started to sing, we were a couple different. We actually were called Grace when we got the record deal. And maybe Glenn might remember better than I, but I believe at the time there was a band called the Graces.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, Charlotte Cathy, the guitarist of the Go-Go's. And so they were concerned that radio stations would confuse, who is this new band? So after we were signed, then all of a sudden we had to come up with a band name. And I can still remember sitting in my parents' basement and we were just throwing around names. And the song Waterfall, I think we're trying to remember, it was called Riverside. There was lyrics in there with that. And it just sounded like easy to remember. You know, we had some kind of silly names before that seemed like solid. It makes sense. And we just went with it.
So it's funny, as we were talking earlier, like pre-internet, like Grace would have been okay. Now, you know, naming something like, I interviewed this young kid from Nebraska recently, and his first name is Jack. His name is Jack Osborne, but he plays under the name Jack, and like try to Google search him. I had to ask the publicist to send me a link to a Spotify page because I couldn't find it. Like there's a million Jacks and there's a million Jack websites, but I could not find his stuff. And so that was maybe a benefit of in the pre-internet days, is that you could be the, or you could be Grace, or you could be a band that was, and not have to worry about a Google search, right?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the funny thing is 1992 or 91, Warner Brothers had the wherewithal to say, change your name from Grace because there's the Graces. We don't want confusion. Okay. Yeah. And our album comes out in 93. And then 10 years later, there's another Riverside band. This Polish progressive rock band comes out stealing our name, but they're from Poland. So I can't blame them, but that's caused massive confusion because we're fits and starts for the past 30 years. So one of our records released as Riverside USA. So if you search us in Riverside, it was a bad name. You got to get something unique. You know,
there's a lot of country bands called Riverside, you know,
and we've played in Riverside, California. Every time we drive down, we've taken countless selfies with Riverside, like road signs. And my kids joke about that. It's everywhere, you know, but it is what it is.
I mean, my last name really is Midnight. And I always take pictures of anything I see with Midnight on it. Yeah. It was German. It was Midnight at some point.
Well, the funny thing is Keith and I are half Polish, and this band that stole our name is this Polish progressive band. Their names are a lot more complicated than ours. That's for sure. I can't pronounce them. That's for sure.
So leading into signing a record deal, were you playing pretty regularly? Like playing live shows?
Yeah, we definitely did. At that one place Glenn just mentioned, J.C. Dobbs, and there was a few other places that we could get pretty regular gigs, and we tried to make a big event out of it. Really exciting. We're young, and, you know, we had a lot of friends that were into it as well. So rehearse. We got a show coming up, and then occasionally we'd get a really cool opening slot. Some of the most memorable ones was, I remember when Glenn told me about this, it was a place at City Gardens, a really cool place. We got to open up for the Jesus and Mary Chain. Wow. I was like, oh my goodness. It just seemed unbelievable. That was a really cool show. And then the Trash Can Sinatras. These are bands that we opened up before we got signed. So it was a pretty cool opening spot to get. But I think luckily the J.C. Dobbs, where we opened up for the Trash Can Sinatras, you know, the booker, they kind of got the sense that we would fit well with them, and really a great time. I'm trying to think, who else, Glenn, did we open up for? Remember anybody else?
After we got signed, we opened up for EMF. Remember that song, Unbelievable?
Okay.
We played on some bills with some other, David Byrne and some other big people. But that Trash Can't Keith, that Jesus and Mary Chain show, that was crazy. But I remember the booker from J.C. Dobbs calling me, and we were the perfect blend of a local band to play with at Trash Can Sinatra. So she said, and she knew I loved them. And she said, Glenn, sit down before I tell you this offer. I was like 22 or I was like, oh my goodness. And it was a madhouse. They're from Scotland and that was their first tour and they were cool guys. And we ended up, we ended up seeing them probably 10 times after that, Keith, you know, we never played with them again, but I talked to them at one or two shows and actually they did a podcast with another podcast guy. And Keith, I didn't tell you this, they act like they remember us, but
get out of here. Well, it's funny. The guitar player, the one brother, I did run into him on the street before one of their shows 20 years ago. And I may have mentioned something. I can't believe he remembers. Yeah. Who knows? Who knows? But to get back to your initial question, before we got the deal, we were looking for shows. There was this kind of odd place called the Philly Cookbook. And we were playing there every Tuesday night for a while, which was pretty darn cool. You know, small, it was fun, a place that our friends would come to. And they were a little flexible about, you know, carding people, which was great back then. But it was hanging up posters, going out, you know, trying to hanging up posters on our college campuses, doing everything we could to bring people out. Because we weren't exactly what the Philly scene was, you know, was supporting at that time. I'm trying to think who else. Tommy Conwell, who else, Glenn? What was that? The Hooters came out of Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
More rock and roll acts. So we weren't the standard for sure.
But were certainly. You guys
making... Okay.
The motivation for us to get our record deal or the inspiration or the fortunate opportunity wasn't from us getting a groundswell of Philadelphia fan base. We would play gigs, small places, to small crowds. You know, we weren't like the Hooters or Tommy Conwell who developed this local massive following that demanded record companies to come out. We were writing and recording, playing gigs whenever we went to 50 people, 100 people, tiny spots, you know, and then doing demos, writing songs. And it's funny to listen back to those demos. And there were some good songs there, but you can kind of see how we progressed little by little, you know.
Yeah, there would be a 5-minute song and 30 seconds of it was like, ah, there's something right there, which you learn that, you know, that's the part you grab onto and then you further develop. But when you're first starting, it just kind of falls into place and you think you've got a song and you just kind of move on.
Were you recording demos and selling cassettes and stuff at shows? CD was probably early CD days, but maybe
cassettes. Glenn was purchased this Tascam 4-track cassette recorder, which was pretty darn good. And we'd set up the equipment in the basement and run the wires through the laundry room and try to isolate things as best as we could. And through trial and error, just get some decent drum sounds. And then, you know, sounded pretty good. We went into the local studios here and there, but when it got to trying to, you know, work on songs, we wanted to be a little more self-sufficient, and that was a lot of fun. You know, you really heard it. And that was a great way for me to start learning how to layer guitars, because you record one guitar part, and it's like, okay, working on things. I can still remember the one song that wound up making our first album, the song called James. Mm-hmm. And there's some really cool riffs, some of my favorite riffs. And I think that they started with this little Tascam, which was like one of the first times I was able to play a couple chords and then just, you know, just jam on it a little bit. Let me see what riffs I can play over this. So it was great times.
Yeah.
That Tascam recorder, you'd use a regular cassette. A regular cassette is a stereo on both sides. So it's two tracks on both sides. But it would turn it into a 4-track. You use only one
side.
I'm
going to grab it 1 second.
Okay. That's mine, Keith. You never paid me for that, probably. Okay. But then we turn it into a 4-track, and then you could bounce, though. You could learn some basic recording. So you had to keep one track open. You could take 3 tracks, record 3 tracks, bounce them to 1 track. You still had 3 tracks open, bounce them down, bounce. And you could get 6-8 tracks, and you put the drums on 2 tracks. There you go. Now, that machine.
Cuts it off a little bit.
Yeah,
it's a little dusty.
Keith, I want that goes in my coffin with me. Okay. actually it gets cremated with me. I'm not going in the coffin. Okay.
It's pretty cool. But, just like with all the at the time, this is what year was this, Glenn? This was like 1987. 87. Yeah.
88. It was after Blue Monday. You know, I bought that and we started working ourselves. But the funny thing is with that four track, you can plug mics like right into like XLRs, like regular, like a Shure FM57. And I would go to concerts. I don't know if you remember the show What's Happening. Like they like bootleg the Doobie Brothers.
Doobie Brothers.
That was me. I took it into a railway children's show.
He took and the whole Tascam.
That whole giant thing. I had it in an army like shoulder like sleeve like kind of like a messenger bag from an army surplus store, and I had at least I think I had SM57s down both arms. Okay, and like the railway children wouldn't even care anyhow. Like everybody records everything nowadays. But the funny thing, I have that recording. I think it was that place in Staten Island, Keith. I'm not sure if you were there or not. But my wife, my girlfriend at the time, my wife now, she's like, I can hear on the put that away. They're going to see that.
Yeah, Glenn was great for recording. I remember we saw Everything But the Girl. Glenn, myself, my wife. And it was an acoustic show for the Amplified Heart album, which is one of my favorite albums by them. And Glenn, he didn't bring that Tascam, but I guess you had a DAT player.
Tiny DAT player upgraded.
Oh, my goodness. We had the perfect seat. To this day, that recording is phenomenal. And that was actually, you know, my girlfriend at the time that I wound up marrying. It was like, really, to have that recorded. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. My goodness.
I just looked at that recording somewhere in my house, Keith, that it's somewhere in my office. I need to
you transferred into onto a CD. I've got the CD version.
Okay, I probably did that, but I just saw the DAT though eventually. That's good stuff.
Okay, so Sire Records starts sniffing around because Steve helps make that connection.
Yep.
Yeah. We did a showcase. What happened was Steve helped us do some demos and got us a spec deal, which means that he had a deal with Warner Brothers and Kinetic, his label, and whatever money we got to record these demos, Warner Brothers had the right of first refusal. Remember those kind of phrases, Keith? You know, right of first refusal. So any money they gave us, Warner's would have the first crack. They could say, here's $5,000 to go do some demos, and then if we want to sign you, we got you locked up. If not, we could say no, then you can use those demos to go elsewhere. And we ended up doing a showcase after that for the bigwigs at Warner Brothers, Seymour Stein, Howie Klein. It was very kind of offsetting.
It was very sterile.
Very sterile. Yeah. Like 20 people in this studio in Manhattan.
Manhattan studio, I think, during the afternoon on a Saturday. So we rented it just so we could kind of control things sound wise. And I think just friends of friends from, up in that area came. So it was maybe 15, 20 people there. And there we are sound checking. And then we're waiting for Seymour Stein to show up. Waiting. I don't know if it was an hour late, 2 hours late. And he comes walking in and there he was. I still couldn't believe it. You know, talk about being a bit nervous. And he sat down, he said hello, and I think we did about three or four songs at the most. I remember one of my pedals, the battery went dead, and I had a fuss with that. My hands were probably shaking. But we did that showcase, and I think he said a few words when we were finished to Steve Lau, and we got a kind of a positive feeling, but we still didn't know. And maybe later that day, we got the thumbs up. They wanted to sign us. That's my memory.
Yeah, it was at least a week or two later because I remember the apartment I was.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Steve Lau called me and said, "Glenn, sit down. Not time to sit down."
That's right. Yeah.
You know, and I still remember that 907 Pine Street, Philadelphia, where my current wife and I were living at the point. You know, and that was my senior year. Keith, you had graduated already. I think you had graduated. I was my senior year or my semester because I took a year off. just about to graduate college. So the good thing was, timing wise, Keith had just got his degree. We got that stuff done. I was about to graduate. So we didn't have to get jobs. We had our degrees in tune, and we weren't going to make a lot of money off this deal, but we got to tour, record, you know, 2-3 years of doing that, and living a mini rock star, you know, kind of existence for a while. It was a lot of fun.
So the album came out in 92. When did you sign the deal?
91, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty quick. That was the summertime when we did the showcase, right? Does that sound right? Or springtime?
Yeah.
And then we went away over...
we recorded in the winter, and then it was probably released in the spring.
I think we started to do some shows supporting it after we recorded and anticipating it coming out, like a little tour that they, you know,
That first tour was in the fall, actually, because we came back by Christmas. Our good drummer insisted we cancel the last 3 shows so he could be home by Christmas, which was...
Yeah,
we weren't all in agreement with that. So the last show was in like Phoenix. We had to drive straight from Phoenix all the way via Knoxville to drop off our sound guy home and cancel 3 shows. Lots of trials and tribulations back then.
And growing up, watching Motley Crue on MTV and seeing them fly in personal private jets and get married to Playboy models, and you know that they were doing all the drugs in the world. I think as a kid, I had this misconception that every rock star gets a $1 million record deal and lives that sort of lifestyle. But what was the reality of the deal you signed? I mean, you don't have to tell me the numbers, but what was the reality
It was pretty cool because we got a publishing deal as well. So we probably did better with that initially, as far as being able to say, well, this is what we're going to do. Now, Grant, at the time I had a $300 a month apartment, so rent wasn't too much. So to disappear, we didn't need a lot of money, but, you know, enough to be able to say, just, this is what we're going to do for a couple of years here. And, you know, bills will be taken care of, but we didn't have too many bills. And like Len said, we were finished college. So that was kind of behind us, which was very timely.
There was book by the Semisonic drummer wrote the book, right? That talked about, did you guys read that book? I don't remember what it was even called, but you know, where he sort of broke it down, you know, I'm just making these numbers up. They got a $1 million record deal, but then he explained the real reality of a $1 million record deal is you pay for all your videos, you pay for all the catering at your videos, you pay for the tour bus, you pay. And by the end of the day, you could probably make more money at McDonald's, right?
That is true, because everything is recoupable. That bus you're getting, it's actually, you're paying for it. You're not paying for it now. All of those things, studio time, every single penny that is, you know, they're paying towards, you know, your success, it's coming out of your pocket eventually if you're going to sell enough albums.
But the one good thing with our situation was that they understood that we didn't spend a lot of money on our record, you know, and we were with a big label, but Steve Lau had all these connections with these people. So we recorded at a huge studio in, Longview Farms up in Massachusetts, that the Aerosmith and Jay Giles and the Blues Brothers and all these places.
The Stones recorded.
Rolling Stones recorded there. But they could charge you $1,000 a day or $100 a day, depending upon who's booking it and what their budget is. So we got that. And then we mixed in Manhattan at the Hit Factory. If anybody at the Hit Factory is like, it could be the same thing, huge amount. And this guy, Jay Healy, who had mixed and recorded, engineered REM records, he mixed our records, but he was on the upside from engineering to mixing. So he gave us a deal because he knew Steve Lau again. And the Hit Factory was giving us a deal because it was all about that. It's all like fake money, almost all that stuff there too. Yeah. And then it got mastered by some at Master Disc. I forget, you know, who the guy did it, but some major guy. But he did us like a discount rate. The budget is what the budget is. You want to do that or do nothing for 2 days? And these guys will, if the budget's $1 million, they're going to charge you X, you know. And we got the tour. The label bought us a van. We toured the country. We played lots of great gigs. It wasn't Motley Crue with groupies and crazy groupies backstage, but we certainly had our share of lots of fun and experiences on the road. And who would beat that when you're 22 years old? We were staying in Motel 6, four of us or whatever. You know, we didn't care. We're going to play a cool gig that night, have a few beers, and play our songs to fans who knew our music.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that was a nice thing, right? You're and with the label behind you, like the local record store when you pulled into town, hopefully had the CD. Right?
Mostly, yes.
And you had a publicist who was booking you interviews as you were rolling into town and that kind of stuff that you probably had not thought about before, but all of a sudden you're getting help because they want to make the money too, right? They want to recoup on it.
It was huge. We would go and, you know, arrive in a town and there would be the A&R guy, local guy, and he'd had connections with the local radio station already. And we stopped and did a lot of interviews. We played some songs live on the radio. So bingo. So this radio station is going to promote our show. So it all kind of synced up very, very well. It was exciting. You'd pull in and a lot of the radio stations were playing the songs already. And it could be a small radio station or a bigger one. And, you know, you're going to the radio station because guess what? You want them to play your song and you're trying to be friendly and do whatever you can. If they wanted us to play a song, sure, we'll play. We'll do anything. You know, was it Glenn? We had the EMF show and then we drove, was it overnight to get to Michigan to do that live morning radio? Was that, is that Michigan or Chicago? I can't even remember.
First three shows on this first radio station sponsored tour. So we're not making a lot of money. The radio stations are sponsoring the tour. So if it's 95.7, they would charge 95 cents for the gig. Yeah. Tons of promo, and we would do interviews there, and a million people there. But Philadelphia would play with EMF, and it was WDRE in Philadelphia. Great station, huge supporter, great show. And then that night, we had to leave to drive to Ann Arbor, like he said.
It was
like on Thanksgiving break. Ann Arbor is where University of Michigan is. The town was dead. There was no radio support. We went from 1,000 people or 1,500 people to like 15 people. And then the next night was Chicago at this place called the Metro, which is a fantastic, pretty sure the Metro in Chicago. Huge venue, great radio station, headline, probably not sold out, but like at least 1,000 people. It was fantastic. It was up and down like that, depending upon what town. What the local A&R guy did to support you and get you those interviews and get you played on the radio. If you get played on that local radio station, you're going to have people come to your show, especially if it's practically free, you know, those gigs.
Absolutely. You played an EMF show. You toured with the Judy Bath. Were you mostly doing other headlining stuff or were you doing sporadic?
That first tour was about a month long. We were mostly headlining, but occasionally we have like a big band like EMF, and there was a radio station thing. So we came home. Then we went on tour a few months later with the Judy Bats as an opening act for about 3 months. Same label. They had a record coming out, and we were the opening act, and it was like a traditional kind of tour. But we were in a van. The label bought us a van, but we were in a van. They're in a bus. They're paying for that bus. They pay for all those expenses. It gets expensive. So for us, it wasn't bad. We could go on their bus sometimes, have our gear in the van or on their bus and their trailer, use the same road crew. It was a lot of fun. So we did the whole country twice, pretty much. One was short and one was longer. And then did lots of intermittent shows around the country ever since.
And like you said, like for all intents and purposes, you were kids.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It's a great way. And I don't know like what your family's travel was like, but like you got to see, did you ever tour outside of the U.S.?
Never did. No, but you're exactly right about seeing the country. It was fascinating. We had a lot of family vacations. Our family vacations were focused on baseball venues. We were big, Keith and I are both baseball players and our kids are big baseball players, and we saw the whole half the country, but doing baseball trips, but going to see every city, you know, every major city in the country. We played five shows in California. California was a fantastic five shows in the like Los Angeles, like, you know, area. It was really, you know, an enjoyable experience, you know. San Francisco was fantastic. You know, I wouldn't have ever been those places.
Yeah, I think our parents were excited for us. And my dad definitely liked to travel a bit, you know, when he could. So I think the idea of us getting a chance to do this and we had graduated school, he was kind of like, okay. I think he was a little worried about the driving aspect of it. Who's going to be driving, all those kind of, and like, you know, no cell phones. So how are we communicating? But, you know, I think he thought that was pretty cool. You know, he got that. He was a big music fan himself, more like, you know, classic Sinatra, Beatles things, but he got it. You know, we're young and we're trying to do something here. So he was very supportive of it.
Do you have any cases of like playing in California and a young band opens for you and it turns out that it's Weezer or something like that? Did you play any shows where like years later you were like, I think we played with that band?
Not that we play with, but I saw the Indigo Girls open up for the Ocean Blue at J.C. Dobbs.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
Yeah, we had no idea who they were. And guess what? These two girls are up there. They owned that bar by the time they were done. I had no idea who they were.
Yeah.
A band like that in a small club, they shined. Their voices were amazing. And that's not exactly my kind of music, but guess what? They were tremendous. And, you know, short time after that, they were just, you know, crushing it.
Yeah. So talking about one again, the Waterfall video, a friend of mine, I mentioned that I was going to be talking to you tonight, and he sent me a screenshot of like somebody has compiled like all these 120 minute playlists and posted them on a website. And he said the first time that you were played, it was right after a Helmet video and right before a Cure video. And I don't know if that was, in order or whether that was just the stuff that was played that night, but like, were you guys watching when that happened? Were you tuned in to see your video get premiered?
We were on the road at that time. I recall, I think it was confirmed, maybe Steve Lau or somebody confirmed that it was on. And, you know, that was pretty darn cool. So no, I don't think we ever watched it live on MTV. So I think they played it a few times. Does that sound right, Glenn?
Yeah, I did not see it broadcast live.
So as a writer back in that time period, I always wonder, were there any reviews that stick out? Like, do you remember, was there any, did Spin review it? Did Alternative Press? Were there any big reviews that you can remember?
Billboard magazine? I think I remember writing a little something about it because we kind of, what was it? We arrived and there was a little bullet by our name because, you know, I guess I forget exactly what the chart was based on, airplay, things like that. But I remember them writing a favorable, you know, a paragraph or so. We did interviews for all different kinds of magazines, some kind of weird, some pretty cool. I can't remember any other large publications.
Yeah.
Billboard, that was probably the coolest thing, seeing our name in Billboard magazine. Yeah. And, you know, I forget how high we got in the alternative charts, but, you know, we did pretty well.
Well, I remember looking back. So we would go to, I lived downtown in Philadelphia, and the Tower, there was Tower Records, if you remember the record stores. Yeah. Does that still exist, Tower Records? I don't think so, right?
I don't think so. Yeah. I think in Japan it does.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But there was also a Tower bookstore, and that was my place. I'm not going to go buy Billboard every week and R&R, I think it was Rockin', I forget what that stood for, but they had all the charts. I remember going to those places and paging through it. So for Billboard, it was Modern Rock Tracks that was charting us. And for R&R, I forget what it was called, but we'd see us creeping up those charts. It was very cool. And I don't remember reviews except for the Billboard one, Keith, but the ads in like all these industry magazines were focused on getting these program directors to add your song.
Yeah,
they would have snippets from program directors, like a big, they take an ad out. I still have all those things, Keith, you know, like I don't even know what kind of, you know, little verbiage they were, some kind of positive things there. I'm sure we got some negative reviews, like they're derivative, they sound like they're trying to be British. You thought the Judy Bats were British. My goodness gracious. You know, so it is what it is. We loved those bands. We didn't think we were trying to, you know, create the wheel or something, you know, try to make interesting songs, interesting lyrics that people love. And people liked our music, loved our music.
Yeah. Yeah. This still exists today, but I remember the 90s, particularly when like commercial alternative radio stations started popping up. And they all, like you said, Glenn, they all did the summer concert where they brought together six bands, eight bands, 10 bands that they were promoting or whatever. Did you play any of those kind of shows?
San Francisco. Does that sound right, Glenn? Yeah. That was a really cool radio promoted outdoor show where I guess it was around lunchtime and it was midweek somewhere, and it was just mobbed. It was such a cool show. That sticks in my mind. We got a great video of that, an okay video of it, but just saw it not too long ago. Just, you know, I'd forgotten so much about it, but I recall that. Anything else, Glenn?
Well, that one was just with the Judy Bats outdoor free, like lunchtime concert with the radio station in San Francisco. But that evening or the evening before or two, we played a big festival thing with multiple bands, David Byrne. I can't even remember all the girls. There was some girl band that was in there, but a bunch of those kind of like big summer festival things there. And sure. I did get in the elevator with David Byrne, and surprise, surprise, he didn't look at anybody. He looked stared at the wall kind of.
Oh, I still, we were waiting for the elevator and the doors open up and David Byrne comes walking out. We knew he was going to be there, but it was just powerful.
Yeah, yes. Darling Buds were there. Oh, David Byrne, a bunch of bands kind of like that were big on that, whatever the big San Francisco. We played a bunch of shows. We played Slims at night. We played like four shows in two nights. Slims is a big venue there, I think. And we played that big outdoor show, Keith, as well for the British.
Who State. Was it in Philadelphia down Penn's Lane? Juliana Hatfield? That was
Juliana Hatfield. Yeah.
That was a radio station.
That wasn't a big festival. That was the only one we went. We never got hooked up with one of those big tours, which would have been a lot of fun to do that.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that there were big tours. They seem to be like whatever the top 10 bands at the radio, or maybe the top three or four bands. And then to your point, like whatever the labels were, like you can have Juliana Hatfield, but you've also got to take our new band, right? Mm-hmm. And fill those kind of things up. So 92, the record comes out and you're doing some touring for it. Tour comes to an end. Like what? So did you get dropped or did you put, I know you recorded a second record, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Step back about who you're going to tour with. We were going to be touring with Ian McCullough, the singer from Echo and the Bunnymen. That was supposed to happen until his budget. Even though his band was going to be in a bus, he had to fly. This is the story we heard. He had to fly from gig to gig. That cut the budget for the opening band.
Oh. We still love you, Ian, though. We still love you.
Still love you, Ian. Thanks, Ian. Could have been whatever. Yeah. That first record did great. They exceeded expectations. We sold a lot of records. And we go on to record the second record. And we had this guy, Paul Mahern, produce the second record. He had been in, I forget what bands he was in. He was in multiple bands himself, but that he had produced Afghan Whigs. He had a lot of indie cred, which is where they kind of were trying to push us more to rather than pop kind of stuff. But I forget what band he was in, Keith. You know his band name? Paul's
no, team. I just remember the Afghan Whigs. The idea was, I mean, if you can imagine, this is Pearl Jam time. Yeah. So I think they thought they were going to try to make us a little rougher around the edges. And I guess we're trying to, you know, cooperate. And it sounded like a good idea. You know, in hindsight, Paul was awesome, very talented producer and all that. But it wasn't the direction we needed to head. And not that not that our songs sound grungy at all, but just with that tone, you know, in our mindset, I think it just, you know, when I listen back to that record that wound up not getting released, I see, you know what, I wish it was a little prettier here or prettier there rather than being straightforward or this or that. Glenn likes it a lot. I think Glenn likes it more than the first one.
But I love that record. And I think Paul Mahern did a fantastic job. He really developed this as songwriters and made those songs better. It is what it is. Why can't you just tell them more? So the thing is, the label that we did demos, they do some more demos, and they like the demos. We go record the record. They like that. They sent us for a photo shoot. They mastered the record. You don't master a record. I mean, it's mixed, and then you go mastering. That's an extra like $20,000 just to tweak it for release. And then the A&R guys got fired. Big shakeup at Warner Brothers. And they decided, oh, I'm not going to release it.
Yeah, there was release date. There was release date was posted in Billboard magazine. Yeah. It was all set to be released, and then, and I think there was some other changes at Warner and Sire, and I think more things even happened after that. But that, you know, if you're not connected with the right person, and so and so gets moved on or gets fired, you know, all of a sudden.
I mean, but the idea of why would you do photo shoots and all the artwork? Why would you master it? You know, and we had this big, expensive photographer. That guy who did those Chris Isaac shoots did the photography for that.
Yeah,
like it's on one hand not knowing what the other hand is doing. They could have certainly released it without much promotion, which would have been better than nothing. You know, but it is what it is.
Did they own the music then? Was that the kind of thing that you had to?
They own the recordings. They paid for the recordings. They're our songs. They own the recordings. And
I forget how that all worked out, that we eventually released it ourselves, that record. But I'm not even sure how we finagled that whole thing. But it never came out on there. We released it independently thereafter.
Yeah.
So then walk me through the rest of the 90s. And into, I mean, I, you know, 2000 was just like 5 years ago, right? But I mean, tell me about the last.
Glenn, we'll have to both kind of chime in here. So that happens, and we're scratching our head and trying to, our manager was still working with us, trying to start up with another label possibly. There were some changes within the band at that time. Glenn and I always stayed together. And it just kind of just faded away to some degree. And, you know, we're still playing, you know, trying to make things happen, trying to make music. And then maybe we took a pause for a little bit. Marriage, kids, you know, I've got a couple of kids now, and I'm sure that kind of got distracted us. But then Glenn and I joined a band, wound up being called Deluxe, where there was a lead singer. He just sang, I played guitar.
You're mixed up with the time frame a little bit.
Okay. Could be. Yeah. But that's a project that just all of a sudden we did for 2-3 years, did some recordings, and we thought that was going to be something else. But then that kind of faded away. What did I skip, Glenn? Did I skip 10 years there?
Yeah, pretty much. But Deluxe happened earlier a little bit.
Okay.
Okay. And that was really a fantastic band. Great, a different singer and guitar player that we were friends with for years. The guy that I walked down South Street and met Steve Lau with, he was the guy that became our singer in that band. And Keith became guitar player and different drummer. It was called Deluxe. And we were on the verge of getting record deals with that band and did showcases and had managers talking to us, but never happened, you know. But it was that was a great band. And then we kind of just, like, as Keith said, have babies. And, like, you know, your kids were born around 2000, Keith, to start probably, or 99.
98, 2000.
Yeah. Our kids, so 98 to 2005, we each had two kids, okay? And then we started still playing together and then still getting it going, but it's a lot harder when you have little kids and paying the bills and get distracted. It's a lot harder to get out of the house to do that stuff, you know? But eventually we kept it going, and there were some tragedies that happened with friends of ours, you know, people pass away, and that kind of, you know,
yeah, that
crazy story. Your best, one of your best friends pass away, but at the funeral you reconnect with old musician friends, and we got it going again with that way with other people. And then that started with our friend John Larish, who was in our bands, you know, for many years. And then lo and behold, we started working with him, re-recording some stuff, played a gig with Kenny at one point, 2004, and then we started working on new stuff. And that was the lo and behold, we did this record called Higher eventually. And that was released, Keith, what year? 10 years ago?
Something like that. But it was a long time.
A long time. We're self-recorded, self-produced completely. Only released it digitally. We're going to probably release it on CD, but you know, it took a long time to do that. And we were very methodical and very, very nitpicky as far as how we wanted that record to sound. It just took forever, you know. And sure. once a year, we play with the Ocean Blue. That's the one thing that really kept us together as far as the idea of playing live was our buddies, the Ocean Blue. Excuse me. Whenever they would come to Philadelphia or DC, New York, they'd have us play with them.
Yeah. So the internet starts, the internet takes off. Do you go back and I was looking up Riverside and finding some stuff and you know, stuff that you weren't reading because they weren't in magazines in 1992, 93. Now people are writing about it. And like Glenn, you were saying like your fans are showing up. Your fans are telling other people about the record now. Do you ever go down those internet rabbit holes and like look yourself up and see what people are saying about it?
Little by little, you can't avoid it. You know, sometimes, yeah. And that's why I say that the folks that like our record love our records
and tell people about it.
Yeah, and right? That's when you see exactly, yeah. And when you see those fan comments, like you're my favorite band, and they list us with all these other, you know, seminal bands. It gives us goosebumps to this day, and that's why we're friends with the Ocean Blue. We have a lot of the same fan base as them, and we go play with them for a long time. We would just play East Coast shows with them, but for years they said, let's go play LA together, come out to LA. And so eventually last fall we went to LA and played with them, and it was a huge venue, almost sold out. But we pull up outside the venue with our new drummer, who's been in the band 20 years now, but a brand new guitar player who's in the band like 2 months, and we get swarmed by old fans that we hadn't seen in 30 years, and they have old albums and CDs and everything for us to sign. And that's just a reminder about what the motivation is behind it. Get those old fans that love those songs and love the music. And it was a thrill to go do that, and a thrill to have fans that really support us. And then just a few weeks ago or a month ago, we went to Austin, Texas with the Ocean Blue, played a couple of shows with them. And we play local Philadelphia shows with them. Our next show is in September with them, but we look forward to continuing to play with them. And it's a great motivation for us. And it's a great connection with those guys. Those are the nicest guys ever. You know, any band that's ever opened or played a gig with them will attest to the fact that they're the coolest guys, nicest guys. And we have the best fan base. And we go to the shows and we meet people who flew in from this place and that place and that place and this place. It's a thrill. It really is a thrill still.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, you know, that's a band that I know the name and I had sort of forgotten about, right? I mean, as you do over the course of time. Mm-hmm. They played in Columbus last year and I'm like, oh, I should, you know, that's a band from the 90s. I should go check them out. Sold out, you know? And so you're right. Like people like they've just got that following that is just, they're not coming to play in front of 10 people. Like their fans are sticking with them 30 years later, which is pretty awesome.
We played two shows in Austin City Limits. I think it holds like 500 people. I don't think either was sold out, but it was packed, you know, like 900 people for two nights back to back. That's why we did it. You know, Philadelphia, we played there with them in September. It sold out instantly. And they're playing two shows at the same venue this September, one with us, one with another very cool band called Asteroid 4, Keith. They used to be East Coast, but now they're based in San Francisco. Very cool guys, great music, and a big thrill we saw that someone posted, they cover one of our songs at their gigs. And that's the coolest thing, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to meeting those guys in person. We've kind of connected through social media. I think it's Asteroid 4. So anybody's out there listening for a cool band, check those guys out. They're playing in September. We're playing one night with the Ocean Blue, and then they're opening the other night. So come to the Riverside show first, and then come the next night to that show as well.
So I sent you guys a picture. I don't know where the cover is, but I have the CD, and I've held onto the CD since 1992. Mm-hmm. I don't listen to it all the time, but I still have it. How did Lost in Ohio, like how did that whole thing come about? Like, was there a clamoring for it on vinyl, or did you have I think you had mentioned that somebody in the band had reached out to or wanted to get it pressed on vinyl or something.
We considered it for a little while.
Many years.
Yeah, we play a show, and then fans would ask about that. You should put it out in vinyl, and I'm sure we read about it online. Some people asking about that, and it's a little costly. And part of it was to do that. You know, Warner Brothers still owns the rights to those recordings, so starting that whole relationship and getting the approval. So we looked into it a little bit, dragged our feet some. But David Calamaro, who's our new guitar player, he's been with us for
a year and a half now.
You know, great guitar player, great friend. He's I've been connected with him for years. He's been in other bands. He helped us do some of our home recordings. So now, you know, he does the California show with us, has a great time, and he's like, he's reinvigorated us in many ways. So he said, why don't you guys put that first album out in vinyl? And we were just like, how's that going to happen? So he reached out to Lawson, Ohio record label. He had been connected with them through other bands he liked, and he started that conversation. And once that conversation started, you know, not too long ago, we were just doing a Zoom call with Bill, and had the thought of the Kickstarter, and all of a sudden, boom, we've reached our goals.
That's the summary. Dave Calamaro wouldn't happen without him.
Yeah.
So before that, though, I mentioned our drummer for 20 years. I don't think I mentioned his name, Tim Simmons. Oh, yeah. Can't forget to mention Tim. Tim, you know, he lives right near – he's buddies with Dave as well. He's been a fantastic part of the band, longer than any other drummer we've ever had. But Dave reached out to Bill Spry at Lawson, Ohio, and got the ball rolling. Keith and I are like, yeah, sure. We'll see when it happens. And he took the ball and ran with it. And also Steve Leo, who is the lighting designer for the Ocean Blue and our lighting designer and our social media guy, does all our websites and all that stuff, Instagram. Keith and I, we have no idea what's going on with that.
Not my strength.
Yeah, so Steve Leo gets our Instagram. We have all that stuff going on. And then Bill Spry does the Kickstarter thing. And those guys together, but they started it. Without those guys behind the scenes, none of it would have happened. And we set this goal to fund it. I said, just no. It's not going to happen. And we raised like 80% of it in like 2 days, you know. And it's fully funded. So it's definitely going to happen. Blue vinyl, yellow vinyl, posters, T-shirts, test pressings, all these kind of things that the Kickstarter kind of programs do, which I had no idea how they worked.
And that's got to be such a great feeling. Like you said, you had no idea if anybody was going to, like, that would have been, would that have been heartbreaking had it not reached it? Or would you have just been like,
I think what I would have thought was, okay, that's disappointing, but the mechanism involved, I'm so surprised that it actually happened, because, you know, just from contacting people through social media, initially I was just like, well, how are you going to, sure, there's some people who may want to buy it, but how is it going to connect with them? How is that actually going to happen? Yeah. And, you know, the machines, you know, were working, and it just got out there.
Nostalgia is a strong pull, a strong magnet, right? Yeah. And all those people who came to see you that loved you in the 90s now are like me, like buying record players and buying records.
Exactly.
And now it's like, you can listen on Spotify, but it's not the same.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Spotify is convenient and it's awesome, and I love having every song ever recorded in history in my hand, but it doesn't beat sitting down in front of a turntable.
Yeah.
You guys have turntables?
I do. I got one for Christmas actually from my family, and I have tons of vinyl as well. And I have the Ocean Blue that they put out maybe 10 years ago, like their first three records on white vinyl, blue vinyl. I just pre-ordered that just to have it, and then didn't play it for 10 years.
Yeah.
I didn't have I finally pulled up my old turntable and the belt was bad, so I just got rid of it and bought a new one. But it really is a thing nowadays, and it's cool, and the fans like it, and it didn't take really that much funding to get it out there to folks, and everybody's happy, I think, with the system.
And just for listeners, to be clear, the it's funded, but it's still, people can still go and
absolutely order. They can still order it. It's pretty much pre-ordering it now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And all the packages with the multicolor vinyls, we're only going to have their limited edition, how many blues and yellows that they really like that. And the posters and the t-shirts and all that, and the I think all the test pressings are sold out, and the associate producer kind of things are all sold out. They can't do that, but they still can get the blue and the yellow vinyl, and they can
awesome.
It's go to Kickstarter, search Riverside, and it comes right up. And
Riverside USA, not Riverside Poland.
No, right? I think it's Riverside. Actually, it's actually for that. I'm looking at it right now. It really for that it's just Riverside. So because Riverside, yeah. The other one is not on Kickstarter. So
yeah.
They figured let's just use that. And that album was Riverside. You know, so yeah. Riverside won, but yeah, it's still there on Kickstarter. Just looked it up. You know,
awesome. For 20, yeah, we'll make sure.
We only funded it for like a month to raise those funds, and we did it in like 10 days. You know, So.
So you've got shows in September with Ocean Blue, and then every once in a while you play one show, but then every once in a while you guys still do some shows? No?
That's a debate. Some of us are more enthusiastic than others. If you leave it up to Dave, our the other guitar player, we'd be playing a lot more often. He was just sending me some texts. I don't know if he sent them to you, Glenn, trying to do some shows with the band the Julies. In Philadelphia. So I think it's going to happen. I think Dave's going to force the issue. So, I mean, I really enjoy the recording and the writing process. And now they can do so much at home. I that's great. The shows, you know, sure. They're a lot of fun, but sometimes I need someone to tap me on the shoulder and say, we need to go do this. Yeah. And Dave is that kind of guy right now. So yeah, we'll be doing some other shows.
So you guys are parents. Both live in Philadelphia area, Pennsylvania?
Suburbs. I live right outside of Philadelphia. It's a Bala Kenwood. It's a town just like Philadelphia's minutes away. Married almost 30 years now. And I got a son and a daughter. Son's 23, daughter's 25. Daughter just graduated from Pitt, a special ed teacher. My son, he actually is a baseball player, a minor league baseball player.
Wow.
In the Los Angeles Angels organization. So he's off to spring training. He's out in Arizona right now. We're going to go visit him at spring training.
That is awesome. And Glenn, you said you were, you've got the kids as well, but you also said you were involved in insurance industry for a while.
Years ago. Yeah. So same thing though. Keith, my kids are about 5 years younger, a daughter, nursing student at Temple. And my son is a high school senior, but a baseball player too. He's going to go play college baseball at Lehigh University next year too. So our kids are kind of like in this. Keith's a year younger than me, but our kids are about 5 years, you know, difference. But our kids are very, very close, and it really that's what kept us together, Keith and I, and our friendship and all that. And you know, especially our sons. Even though my son and Keith's son, baseball, and Keith and I are baseball addicts as well as music addicts. It's really helped us stay together, going to watch Keith's son's games. He comes to watch my son's games and also to rehearse. We have rehearsal tomorrow night, you know, with the band. Yeah. And it's a great time to do that. We're working on new songs. We're working on a new record. We have one song completely recorded, but it takes us a long time to get that stuff finished with everything else out there. But maybe we'll do a Kickstarter to put that on vinyl as well. But we can do a lot of home recording. It's a lot more economical nowadays.
Not only economical, but if you finish a song tonight, you can upload it somewhere and have people hear it tonight, right? Yep. Like you don't have to wait 6 months for something to come out.
Yep.
Unless you mix it and remix it and remix it and remix it, like we do.
Well, that's where we're kind of stuck right now. We've got somebody helping us out. We're making some progress. But it's been a little while.
And then really the last question, because Dig Me Out, in the spirit of the Dig Me Out podcast, is there a band that you think was overlooked, underappreciated, that you think that we should investigate and have the two hosts find an album and review it? Anything you can think of that?
Instantly. Looks like, the Railway Children. Absolutely. And those guys had some more success than we did, but they were, you know, classic songs, you know. Album after album, song after song. But for someone who's really buried, I don't know. Keith,
Children, I think that counts. I mean, you mentioned them a few times. I've seen their name a bunch. I've never listened to them, so I'm going to check them out after we get done here. So,
well, do you know the Trash Can Sinatras, who I mentioned earlier?
Yeah. I think I saw them at South by Southwest. Maybe.
Okay.
They're still playing. They still are making new music, putting it out. They're still traveling. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of our favorites. I mean, it's a matter of, you know, could they have been more successful? Lloyd Cole and the Commotions. Mm-hmm. He's one of our favorites, and he's still writing and recording and touring. Glenn was trying to get us a gig as being his backup band. That did not work out, though. But that was it. Was a play. He made a contact with Lloyd, and it not yet happened.
I barged into like a backstage kitchen of a local venue he was playing, and introduced myself and proposed that. So that's still on the table. But I think the Trash Can Sinatras, they are continuing to put out fantastic new songs. I mean, their most recent recordings are the best that they've ever had. And they had this modicum of success, but those guys definitely deserve Ed Sheeran, whatever, you know, great, but Ed Sheeran he's not 2 billion and these guys are 100,000, you know, they're a lot closer. And I like Trash Cans better, but their songs are beautiful, beautiful melodies, catchy, beautiful vocals, and countless hits they have.
Yes.
Yeah. You know,
That's a good one. Those are both Railway Children and Trash Can Sinatras are good ones, and I will definitely propose those to the host and see what they do. Well, I am out of questions. I absolutely appreciate it. It was so, like I said, I mean, I have the CD. It brings up memories of being in college and my girlfriend. And so when I got the email from Tim, who is helping out with some of the press, Tim's a friend of mine. I think I don't know if he's doing press for the Kickstarter thing, if you even know who Tim is. Tim's a guy that lives in Dayton, Ohio, which is an hour away from me, and we've met a few times and traded emails back and forth. But I ended up on some mailing list that said there's a Kickstarter for Riverside, and I'm like, I remember that band. I think I still have the CD. So I'm so glad that it ended up in my inbox, and I it made me go back and re-listen to their album that I haven't listened to in a while. So everything all works out in the end, I think.
Yeah. Well, one more band that's lost in the shuffle in the Philadelphia music scene. The Resistors. Okay. Yeah, you have to dig deep to find them, but they were a fantastic band. My uncle was the singer and songwriter behind that band. Without them, we wouldn't exist, as I mentioned earlier. But I think Trash Cans and Railway are probably two good starting points for bands you might want to investigate.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Chip, great meeting you.
Yeah, a lot of fun. As well.
And we really enjoyed talking about all the history and all that stuff. Great questions and great job.
Yeah, thank you so much, Chip. A pleasure. Hopefully we'll connect again sometime very soon.